This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode 423 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Kat Kay.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing... I'm sorry, not this week. This episode, we are continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with starting... with chapter 60, entitled Deserter Game, Round 2.
Jamie meets a young Polish engineer he names Kos, or Kosh, Kos. However it's pronounced, I don't know. We'll have to listen to Davina. What did Davina say? Kos?
Don't ask me that. I wasn't paying attention.
He shortens the name because it's just so long to say. Jamie's able to communicate with him because languages, and because of his, he's an engineer, and because of his conversations in the past with Brianna with regard to engineering. Kos had come to fight in the war, first for money and maybe girls, but then as he read more and became friends with Thomas Jefferson and learned more about the American cause, he is now actually fighting on principle. So Jamie and Kos have lots to talk about, and they have deep thoughts. Then, Jamie is practicing his back float in the river when a distraught Rachel comes to get him. Denny has lost at his deserter game. So they make a plan to get him back.
It was really sad, man.
I know.
You've got Claire syndrome.
Who? Rachel?
Denny.
Oh.
If there's an opportunity to get kidnapped, you're going to get kidnapped. He's got Claritis.
I mean, she doesn't drop that many. He doesn't curse like her, so that's a difference. I'm trying to think, how else are they different besides man-woman thing? We don't know about his glass face thing.
Who probably wasn't diddled inside of an ancient ruins of Castle Dune.
That's the TV show.
It sure is. But my point is that he's very different from Claire.
My point is, you are making a point that he is like Claire.
He can get
himself into trouble. And I was trying to say, or figure out as we're talking, is it okay, or is it right, or how close is it to say he's like a male Claire? Before I say that or can defend that, I have to differentiate how he's not male Claire. He does not curse like her. He does not do a lot of things like her. Diana never says he has a glass face. However,
he's a soft male where she is a strong female.
That's exactly. And he can't really lie or easily because of being a Quaker and all that.
There is a median ground between hard females and soft males.
Okay.
And soft sounds like an aggressive statement, but it's not. It's just a man who does not identify with
machismo.
Thank you. And then you have a woman who is not part of the don't touch me. I have my rights. You don't get to tell me what to do. I'm a full grown person. So those two things kind of meet in the middle. And I feel like they found their middle ground.
Plan was to hang Denny, of course. So Jamie and Ian sneak into the British camp to rescue him. As they look at the tents to consider which might hold Denny, they see William. They agree it has to be Ian that is going to go do the rescuing, while Jamie causes a diversion. So Ian can also get around the camp more easily because he can say he's a scout, which he is, just not necessarily for the Brits. And he won't be in danger if William recognizes him. I mean, it's not great if he does, but he won't like be in danger of being caught or anything. Jamie was, as I said, going to create a diversion that would allow Ian to get Denny out. Ian gets to the tent, reaches under it, and Denny sees his hand. He then slides under the tent. Denny is in full irons. Ian was going to help basically hold Denny, help him slide out from under the tent and pull him out, and then put him over his shoulders like a dead fawn, Diana writes, and whisk him away. Of course, as he's pulling him out, William comes on by. William looks at the whole situation and says, quote, "Don't tell me, I don't want to know."
No, unquote. Accurate. Do not make me a party to this.
And then he's, but he doesn't say, but his actions don't, I mean, they're not directly.
He's not saying don't give do me information. It. He's just saying don't.
I don't want to know anything.
Not even give me, just don't implicate me as a co-conspirator in this.
I don't want to know any information other than what my actions right now. Then he helps Ian pull Denny out and helps him get him on his shoulders. And then tells him, dang, for someone who doesn't want to help, he's helping a lot. And then he tells him where the latrine trenches are and the pickets. So he's telling him over to the left are these trenches, like don't fall in, and then avoid the pickets because they might shoot him.
Don't fall in, but please poop in them.
A few moments later, as they're on their way, someone yells, fire! So, sorry, not fire, but fire. Well, no, that's true. They both can
fire.
That's
okay.
Not great. I was trying to differentiate between fire your weapon and oh my gosh, there's fire in the house. And it came out of me almost sounding the same. So whatever.
That was chapter 60. Moving right along to chapter 61, entitled "No Better Companion Than a Rifle." This is the NRA chapter.
Summer. This series is sponsored by the NRA. What are you on about? September 15, 1777. It took months, but the various militias finally reached, I say months. It was in July, so like a month and a half, just over a month, I guess. So, Ginger, that's a little bit exaggerating. No, almost 2 months. So, yeah, okay, Ginger, it was just over 2 months. It was early July when Ticonderoga happened and they left and they were chased. And then now it's mid-September. So about 2 months or just under 2 months or about 2 months for the various militias finally to reach the main army, which was in early September, but because they were well supplied, Jamie got a tent to stay in, which was a first for them in this army situation. And which means Claire got a tent too. And they had a table. She was very happy with the table.
Just imagine those confirmed rights are being gifted to you as a bonus for your situation.
Jamie brings her a book. No, he had not taken it from a dead person. He had found it at the edge of a creek, which means it was probably dropped in someone's retreat. And we find out that Claire, who can't read the book, needs glasses, but they actually both do. The plan is to get glasses made when they get to Edinburgh. Then arrives a Daniel Morgan, a famous rifleman, apparently from history. He sees how Jamie had shot the chickens that they had. They were wild chickens for their food through the eye because he doesn't want to destroy the meat or damage the meat. And he's like, hey, yo, I see how well you shoot. Come and join my band or his brigade. So he's like, sure. And Claire was happy because riflemen, number one, were very, very sought after and like highly favored. Sounds like the Virgin Mary. Necessary, and there weren't a lot of them, so they were very valuable, so they were treated rather well. And because of their ability, they necessarily fought from a distance, so they likely nothing is guaranteed, but very likely would be safer than those who were in the thick of the fighting.
Oh yeah, because they're only able to pay for whatever they're going to be able to pay for smaller situations. So if they're trying to move forward their task, they're not giving the new people the same amount of whatever that they get themselves because they're trying to move forward while keeping what they have.
Well, it's not about new, it's about his skill. A woman comes to Claire asking if she's the Conjure Woman. She's like, yep. And thus begins her popularity. Morgan, the rifleman, then performs the end of his show. He strips to the waist and shows off his scarred back. And he says he was flogged by the Brits. And this, more than anything else, endears Morgan to Jamie. Back at the British camp, Ian is back, which means he had rescued Denny, and now he came back to it. He walks to the Indian camps, and he sees William, and he's like, ah, dang it. Also because William sees him, and of course he follows him, and now Ian's like, damn it, now I gotta leave. So he runs in, or he's walking, as he's leaving, he sees his old friend Glutton, and he called. Glutton had called to him, and Ian responded in Mohawk that an Englishman was following him and he had to go. And Glutton begins to play act a drunken man and helps tie up William, meaning keep him busy so Ian can get away. And then Ian takes off. As he leaves the camp, he sees that there's a Mohawk camp like nearby, but he does not enter the Mohawk camp. But it's too late. Even though he doesn't enter the Mohawk camp, he notices or sees that Sun Elk, who was there, had noticed him, and he comes after him. They tussle. And of course, because he won't give up, William shows up again. Mm-hmm. And William wants to talk. William is, I'm not going to say that. That did not sound very nice. William wants to talk. He doesn't want to know any of his business. He just wants to thank him for the horse and the money that he had left for him when he was with the hunters. And he wants to know, like, are they safe? Is everybody okay? And Ian says, yes, they're both with the, quote, other army. And yes, he promises to tell Rachel hi for him. And William, as they leave each other, William's like, also, bro, we're even. No more of this help. I owe you nothing now. We're done.
Right? He's like, we've made our stand. We're good. Moving right along to chapter 62, entitled One Just Man.
September 19th, 1777, Ian tells Claire that General Arnold's plan between him and another, Howe is British, whoever the other general was there, had won out. They were going to make the first move against the Brits, and Jamie's already gone out with the riflemen. So Claire waits with the other women for the battle to end. Once it did, she was ready to go in and tend to the wounded. Near the evening when the battle had ended, Claire sees a boy scavenging a dead British soldier, but also, I mean, the scavenging, okay, is one thing, but also like bashing in his face of a dead man. Like that's a bit, woo. But she walks on. She's like, he's dead. I got to find Jamie. I got stuff to do. So she walks on looking for Jamie. She finds him lying on his stomach, knowing he's wounded or knocked out or something. And fully planning on going to see what. And, but she sees someone like beats her, darts toward his body, and Claire grabs, goes toward them. Cause she's seen, first of all, she's experienced in other wars, but she's seen how, people are scavenging these bodies, right? The dead bodies. And at this point, she doesn't know, that he's wounded, or she knows he's either wounded or dead because he's not moving, but she doesn't know that he's not dead yet. But this person comes out of nowhere and is going towards his body to claim it, to be able to take the stuff from him. Claire grabs the person by the hair and tells him to stop. It was a woman. And shortly thereafter, the woman's child, and she had seen these two before. I think it was the same child she had seen earlier, but a woman and her child, we're trying to claim Jamie's body to loot.
Dude, that was aggressively unacceptable.
It was gross.
It was awful. And they clearly didn't realize that Claire was there to be like, stop messing with my man. And they were like, dude, it's just a dude who's almost dead on the battlefield. This one's ours. Go find another one. And she's like, I don't think you understand. This is not just a dude on the battlefield. That is mine. So you are not allowed to kill him to get whatever you want.
So that's not going to work. Claire threatens them, and they notice because the boy, I don't think it's the woman because she had a hold of the woman. So I think the boy went over. So the boy notices, he feels his neck and he has a pulse. He notices he's alive and he's like, I'll slit his throat to, we'll make it quick. So Claire at that point grabs the boy and holds him around the neck. Oh, so maybe it's the mother. I think the mother was threatening to
The mother was threatening to kill Jamie, and the child was being threatened by Claire.
Yeah, so Claire grabs the boy and holds him around the neck. So the mother tries to reason with Claire. Nope. And then she sees the glint of Jamie's sword and grabs it. When she stands up wielding the sword, they listen to her. As they looked daggers at her, Diana writes, quote, the boy's eyes stayed fixed on me as he went, dark coals in the dim light. He would know me again, and I him, unquote. So I noticed this before. This is not the first time. My question is this meaning that they were so intent looking at each other that if they ever crossed paths, like they would recognize each other in a crowd? Or is this some kind of forewarning that they will meet again by Diana? We won't know until we won't know. We don't know. turns out Jamie only had, I mean, he did have a head injury, but he also had a hand injury, which was worse than the head injury as far as the degree. I mean, any head injury is not great. So that obviously could kill you. But it was like a bump on the head as opposed to the like his hand being sliced open. Once he's back at camp, she doctors him. And he tells her, just take the damn finger off. Just get it. Take it. She's like, I can't.
She's like, I won't do that. I can fix it. Shh.
And she finally, but later she finally says, okay. She gets an assistant for the medicine or the medical wagon. And she's instructing or educating people about triage and how to do basic things and has them set about doctoring as well. After a long, hard night, but no rest, she comes back to Jamie and sets about taking the finger. She gives him, she preps her surgical station. She gives him laudanum. And Jamie is thinking like, literally slice it off, take it, get done. And she's like, no, and that's why she didn't do it quickly earlier. She's like, if I can take the time and leave you with a really nice or nice as possible working hand, that's what we want. So it's not urgent. It will not affect your life at this moment. Let me go take care of the shiz. When I come back and things are quieter and people are relaxing, I don't know. People are resting after the battle. And people have been tended to, who can be, I will come back and I will do a better job because I can. We have that opportunity. If I had done it earlier, it would have had to be quick, and I can't promise how well it would have been. So she preps for a while and she wants, as I said, she wants to leave him a working hand. And in the end, she takes off the finger that was first damaged by BJ Randall all those years ago.
Do you think that was healing in some way for Jamie?
I think maybe for both of them, kind of. I think it was sad for her because obviously she mourned not necessarily his finger, but this piece of flesh had been with them both.
No, but his agility, his movement, his writing, his body. And now we're moving along to chapter 63 entitled Separated Forever from My Friends and Kin.
Back with William, he has had his first rebel kill. The conditions in the camp or of the troops are pretty grim. The American camp, however, was in good spirits by comparison. The Brits were short on food, but the Americans were short on ammunition. Ian, as he's walking back to camp, punctures his foot after stepping on a discarded gun spike and uses, and he doesn't need to, it's a perfectly good excuse to visit Rachel in the medical tent with Denny, but he doesn't need the excuse because he truly needs medical. He needs medical looking after attention. And as he's thinking this, and as he's walking to go find the medical tent where Rachel's at, he's not paying attention about everything around him. And he walks straight into a ravine, hitting his head on a rock. So now he's limping because of his foot, but now he's seeing double because he hit his head.
Because choices.
And as he's making his way to Rachel, we hope, he runs into Hamish. Yes, the same Hamish of Castle Leoc, the son of Colum. And they talk about a little bit about the past. And then Rachel shows up. Ian tells Hamish, you'll want to see Uncle Jamie. So when Jamie wakes up, he sees his mended hand. Claire offers to dispose of the finger. And he's like, well, he suggests a funeral for the finger, much like they'd had for Fergus's hand.
He's like, no, keep it. And then we can carve it into a new Sawney. And then it can be a new thing that we pass around the family.
Then Hamish arrives to see Jamish.
Jamish.
How did he get to be here? Like, how, out of all the places in the world, how did Hamish come to be here? Hamish says,
for real though, how?
It was the king's soldiers who killed his uncle. It was the king's soldiers who killed the fighting men of the clan, who destroyed the land, who left the women and bairns to starve. So he was 11 when they were all turned out of Castle Leoc by the Brits. And he was 12 when he arrived in Nova Scotia. So how did he get there? I mean, he traveled there from Nova Scotia, obviously. But the why is pretty clear. And when he just has that little speech about what the Brits all did to him and his kind.
Do you ever kind of wish that you had family members who...
Go visit them? Yes.
Migrated to, like, Nova Scotia.
Oh.
When we were young, so we could just be Canadian.
I just want to visit.
No, I said be Canadian. And that was chapter 63, moving right along to the final chapter of this week's read-along, which is 64, entitled Gentleman Caller.
A man appears in Claire's tent, looking healthy and whole, and he seems to want to do business of some sort. He actually needs some of her cinchona bark for someone in his command who has malaria. He wants to trade the bark for perhaps some laudanum. And as they're
She was very enamored with the laudanum from the beginning.
Very much so. As they're talking biz, Jamie arrives. And he sees who's there, and he gives a slight bow, and he's calling him sir. So Claire immediately knows that this dude is well-respected in the camp. And introduces himself as Major General Benedict Arnold. Now, Claire rarely gets flummoxed or flapped. But when she does run into historical figures, she comes close.
This was hard, though.
Yeah. Because, yeah, so what she said is that, or tells Jamie is that, or I guess, I don't think she's telling Jamie, but it's in her inner monologue. She fully expected to run into historical figures like Bonnie Prince Charlie or now George Washington. Like, you know, it still might throw her, but she knows it's very, very possible for the time, the place, and what they're doing. And she knows Benedict Arnold is a historical figure, but that one, as Summer just implied, that's a doozy because she knows like what this guy ends up being or does. And that is what kind of throws her for a loop. Not the fact that she met a historical character.
No, it throws her for a loop. And then she also is thrown personally for a loop because she's thinking, do I fix this? Do I find the reason why he turned? Do I make this not be a thing that happens in the future? So can I do that? So she's got all of these. Every time we time travel with Claire, she's always got so many levels of interaction that she.
I don't think she's thinking of whether she can do anything. Jamie wonders, oh, you know something about him? And she goes, yes, he will be a traitor. She fills him in on the little bit that she does know. At some point, he, quote, became disillusioned, decided to switch sides, and began making overtures to the British, using a man called John Andre as a go-between, unquote.
Right.
The latter, Andre, was captured and hanged, but Arnold got away to England. Quote, for an American general to turn coat was such a spectacular act of treason.
Sure did.
That the name Benedict Arnold became a synonym for traitor, unquote. But she doesn't know when. She doesn't know when. She doesn't remember this. And you know, when she was, you know, hanging out around her daughter, when she was learning this stuff, it wasn't important to know dates and details. But Jamie's like, okay, so I'll keep an eye on him. And she's like, no, I think even you keeping an eye on him, if he, while that itself may not change history, if he senses it in any way that you've changed toward him, even as little as he notices you're keeping an eye on him, that may make him more careful and may in the future change what he does or how he does it. So she says, we don't know what one small thing might affect someone's mind.
And that was chapter 64. Please join us next time when we will be continuing our An Echo in the Bone read-along with chapter 65, entitled Hattrick, 66, entitled Deathbed, 67, entitled Greasier Than Grease, 68, Despoiler, 69, Terms of Surrender, and chapter 70, entitled Sanctuary. Please join us to continue this read-along.
Again, a very special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Kat K.
And if you just can't get enough of Outlander and you need more time to talk with Outlander fans, please join us in our group at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And if you're interested in some Outlander Pod branded merch, please check out our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
If you haven't subscribed to our newsletter, the Outlander Pod Gazette, please do. Find us at outlanderpod.com/newsletter. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.